Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast, the place where the cool, creepy kids come to learn about their true crime. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman on June 12, 1994. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for The Deathcast, Deathcast Podcast, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways that you can do this. First and foremost, you go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. Or you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $2.99 a month, you can become a member of the Patreon family, get access to exclusive content, as well as early ad-free shows. Speaking of Patreon, as always, I have to give a shout-out to my first Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Thank you guys so much. It's greatly appreciated. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself a nice comfy chair, get a drink, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week. It had just turned into the early morning hours of June 13th. Officers are at both the North Rockingham and South Bundy Drive scenes, and the officers at North Rockingham had discovered a bloody glove as well as what they believed to be blood spots in the driveway of O.J. Simpson, as well as blood on his Bronco, which was parked out into the street. And as the early morning hours begin to dawn, Detective Tom Lang, Mark Furman, and Phillips are going to go back to the South Bundy crime scene so that they can begin processing what has taken place over there. Initially, they'd only gone to North Rockingham to inform Simpson that his ex-wife had been found slain, and obviously, this turned into a much bigger ordeal than they had suspected it of being. Naturally, because of the things that were found at North Rockingham, as well as the fact that Simpson was not on the scene, Simpson immediately moves up their list on their list of suspects. See that the officers are going to eventually be charged with targeting Simpson really right from the start. However, according to the officer's own statements, this is untrue. It was only after Furman found the glove as well as the blood spots on Simpson's Bronco that he began to emerge as a suspect in the detectives' minds. Around 7 a.m., detectives Mark Furman and Brad Roberts return, bringing with them the photographer, Rolf Rocker. Furman directs the photographer to take pictures of the various things found at the Simpson estate. Now that it's daylight, the officers are able to look through the windows on the front of the house, and they see blood spots on the floor in the foyer. With this discovery, it's decided that they officially have a crime scene, and Van Adder takes the step of ordering the property closed down. That's a tricky situation because they still do not have a warrant to search the Simpson property. And despite what they're going to say in court, they really have no ground to stand on as far as taking possession of the Simpson property for processing. Were Simpson there, he could simply have told them to get the hell off of his property and come back with a warrant, which would allow him to clean up any messes that they might encounter. The officers then inform A.C. Cowlings and Arnell Simpson that they're going to have to take the children and leave the Rockingham estate, as it is now officially a crime scene. At 7:10, a criminalist by the name of Dennis Fung from the LAPD Scientific Investigation Division, also known as SID, arrives at the Rockingham estate to begin processing everything that has been found. A woman by the name of Andrea Mazzola, who is fairly new to working in SIDS, also arrives with Fung. Detective Van Adder instructs the criminalists that everything that is visible in plain view needs to be collected. What that means is he's not going to risk their investigation by physically entering the Simpson household and possibly cause problems once this thing goes to court, should it go to court, by going into the home. Instead, he insists that everything that really is outside of the physical dwelling be taken. This includes the drops of blood as well as the glove found in the alley behind Simpson's home. It should be noted that the first piece of evidence that Fung processes is the small red speck found above the door handle on the Bronco, and this is very quickly confirmed to be human blood. Van Adder then turned the crime scene over to Furman and Roberts, as he informs them that he needs to go and secure a search warrant for the rest of the property. At the South Bundy crime scene, Detective Tom Lang has taken control of things. He got there roughly 6:45 a.m. They quickly contact the coroner's office, basically letting them know that they have two bodies at the residents that are going to need to be collected after the crime scene has been reviewed and processed. And that's something a lot of people seem not to understand. They believe that when a crime of murder takes place, the body is almost immediately removed. That is not the case. Oftentimes, bodies will remain where they were found for hours, or in some cases, such as Columbine, even days after a crime has been committed. Obviously, this can lead to problems later on as decomposition begins almost immediately and elements such as the weather can lead to false discoveries on the bodies. And I'm going to talk about this pretty quickly. There's a general belief among the public that time of death can be established for a victim with a great deal of certainty by taking the temperature of the liver. This is a falsehood, okay? The coroner's office can get an idea of when they believe that the individual was either murdered or died, but it is not something that is set in stone. Again, as I just mentioned, elements such as the weather can affect the cooling off process of a body, but they can also keep the body warmer longer. And by that, I mean the internal temperature of the body, because that's what they're concerned with. But not only that, it has been discovered that despite what movies and television shows and even police officers will tell you, every crime scene is different, and every body goes through the various stages of lividity at a different rate of time. And this includes the cooling off, and it's because of this that the idea of establishing a time of death has become somewhat controversial, as defense lawyers have been able to argue somewhat successfully that finding out the time of death based on the liver temperature is, in fact, a pseudoscience that cannot be proven conclusively case after case after case. And that's why some jurisdictions do not allow that evidence to be admitted into court, which makes it that much more important for detectives on the scene and crime scene investigators to gather as much evidence as possible in order for them to piece together what happened, a time they believe that it happened, and eventually to be able to put this all together and present it in open court as their case. Now, back to the crime scene at South Bundy. After Lang arrives and officially takes control, he sets officers to various tasks, including going through the garbage cans that are on the property. He also attempts to contact Simpson in Chicago, only to learn that Simpson has already checked out and is, in fact, on his way back to Los Angeles. At roughly 7:30, Van Adder returns to the South Bundy crime scene and fills his partner in on the further developments over at the Rockingham estate. Van Adder then leaves and heads over to Western Los Angeles to get the search warrant for Simpson's property. Another thing that causes problems later on in the case is what Lang decides to do next. The media has already gotten a whiff of what has taken place, and they're starting to slowly converge on the South Bundy Drive crime scene. While this presents some ethical problems for the officers, as they don't want images of Nicole Brown Simpson's body splashed all across the news, this really isn't an issue of the violence and gore so much as it is respect for the victim as well as the victim's family not to have these images out there in the public domain. Lang asks one of the other detectives on the scene to find him a clean sheet. Unfortunately, the detective is not able to find one and instead returns with a knit hospital-type blanket that was discovered in an upstairs closet in Nicole Brown Simpson's condominium, and this is where a bit of controversy arises. They place the sheet over Nicole's body. Why is this controversial? Because despite their best intentions, the officers may have now just contaminated the crime scene. In fact, they not just may have contaminated the crime scene, they have contaminated the crime scene by altering the body. In a crime scene such as this, where there is a dead body, nothing is to touch that body until the scene has been processed and it's officially decided that the victim can now be removed from the crime scene. Placing this blanket over her body contaminates the crime scene as it can introduce elements that were not present on it during the course of the attack and may lead to false discoveries when they're processing everything, Because as you are well aware, if you've been listening to this show for any length of time, transfer is something that happens between human beings and objects, other human beings, but there can also be transfer from object to object. Putting this blanket on top of Nicole Brown Simpson's body really allows for transfer from this blanket onto her. Lang would later argue that the reason he did this, A, was for the moral reasons, but B, because he knew that Nicole's body was evidence, that the position it was in was evidence, and that by covering it, they were preserving that evidence. I would argue that there were other means to shield the media from seeing her body without actually disturbing it or introducing fibers, etc., to her body that were not present at the time of her death. I've seen this at other crime scenes. Officers will string up a piece of rope and then take a sheet and hang it over it far enough away from the body that any fibers, etc., that are on this sheet will not get onto the body. It would not have been extremely difficult for the officers to have done something in this manner without compromising their crime scene. Another tactic that Lang would try and use for having done this is because he wanted to, in his own words, keep an edge should someone attempt to step forward and claim responsibility for this crime. Meaning that the position of Nicole's body, as well as the wounds that it had suffered, were holdback evidence that the detectives were going to keep, so that should anyone come forward, they would have to describe with great accuracy not only what was done to Nicole's body, but also where her body lay when they left. That particular aspect is a good bit of police work, at least in my opinion. They're taking the largest portion of the crime scene, specifically where Nicole is laying, and keeping it from the public consciousness. They did not, in fact, do anything with Ron Goldman's body, as it was felt that it was not able to be seen from the street. So instead, they continued on with the processing of the crime scene. Again, they go into the house. They discover the cup of Ben and Jerry's sitting on the stairwell near the banister. This is actually over by the garage entrance. A knife on the edge of the counter, along with the candles burning in the living room and the music playing. It was assumed at this point by Lang that there was a possibility that Nicole Brown Simpson was expecting Ronald Goldman for a possible romantic encounter. And that is not an idea that I'm going to ever take off of the table, as I believe, given the fact that we know Goldman was warned about having any kind of relationship with Nicole, and the fact that he is known to have driven her Ferrari, there is a very good chance that they had some type of relationship that was more than friends. Upstairs in Nicole's bedroom, the television is found to be on, and it is also noted that the lights are all on and candles are lit in this room as well. The bed appears to have been laid on, although not slept in. There are candles burning inside of the bathroom. And that the tub, which had earlier been filled with water, has now been emptied. This isn't anything that the officers have done. Even the best bathtubs, the stopper at the drain will allow a small amount of water to leak through, given the fact that it has been 7 hours since the discovery of the bodies. It's not unheard of for a bathtub to completely drain itself. Also in the bathroom on the floor is a pack of Marlboro lights and a little floor carpet or rug, the kind you might put out, you know, a bath mat, that has a red stain on it. This is going to be taken to evidence by the SID team in order to be processed to determine whether or not this is in fact blood. They then go on to inspect the children's rooms, and nothing seems to be out of place there. Going back outside, Lang notes that the gate on the west end of the walkway is open and that there are at least 2 drops of blood on the inside of the lower rung. This is evidence that has already been mentioned to Lang, but now in the light of day, he is better to closer examine them. What Lang is doing by going through the crime scene and re-seeing all of this is taking notes so that when the SID team arrives from the Rockingham estate, he can give these notes to the photographers and the crime scene analysts so that in addition to anything they may themselves might find, they can go over each one of these items and take it into evidence, photograph it as is, for later processing and presentation in court. Near the gate, he sees that the bloody shoe prints, which are present very heavily over near where the bodies were discovered, have begun to fade, as well as drops of blood. This leads again to the idea that the killer or killers became injured during the slaughter of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman and were bleeding as they left the crime scene. This blood evidence is going to be taken. It's interesting to me that the officers immediately jump to the conclusion that the blood is that of the killer, given how violent the crime scene was, how much blood was spilled from the victims, it could very well have belonged to the victims, because you have to imagine that the killer is going to be coated in blood, given the fact that those victims had their throats slit, which means blood is going to be pouring out. That much blood getting on to an individual, if it gets on their shirt or if they're wearing gloves, is going to soak them and will drip off. Lang also notes that there are a dime and a penny lying in the driveway in the back of the house. Now, to give you a good idea of what this driveway looks like, there is a Jeep parked there as well as Nicole Brown Simpson's Ferrari. And Lang will postulate that it's his belief that after the killer committed these crimes and fled out through the West Gate, they had stopped and reached into their pocket to pull their car keys out, and in the process of this had dropped these 2 pieces of change in the driveway before getting into their vehicle and fleeing. Out in front of the house, Lang also takes note of the blood-splattered white envelope that is lying between the bodies of Nicole and Ron, and he later stated in court that he very carefully took a pen and peered inside of this envelope, at which point he could see that there were glasses inside. Other items that don't appear to be connected to the crime include a label from a piece of fruit and a takeout menu from a local restaurant. Going to the front gate, it's noted that this particular gate either requires a key to open or for someone to hit a buzzer, which will then sound inside of the house, at which point the occupant can either choose to push another button and let the visitor in or ignore it. Pressing the button from inside of the house, they discovered that the gate does not, in fact, unlock. With this piece of information, Lang speculates that it's possible that Goldman had come up, hit the intercom button, and that Nicole had then come out of the house to manually open the gate, with the two of them walking back towards her condominium, at which point the assailant struck. It's important to make note of this because later on we're going to get a different theory in that Goldman may in fact have come upon Nicole being assaulted. It's a possibility, however, there isn't a whole lot of evidence to support this particular idea unless Goldman witnessed Nicole being assaulted in front of the condominium and was somehow able to clear the fence that surrounded it without leaving any evidence that he had in fact gone over it. Not saying that that's not outside of the realm of possibility, as Ron Goldman was, again, he's 25 years old, he's fairly physically fit. It is possible that he hopped the wall to go and save his friend from what was happening, but it's interesting that there's no evidence to support that particular line of thinking. He also put forth the idea that the killer may have had a key to the gate, which allowed the killer to gain access. However, given the fact that the evidence seems to point to the killer coming in through the west side gate, I don't believe that's really a viable option in terms of how this crime was committed. It's during this period of time, the early morning hours, that the detectives at the crime scene first learned that O.J. Simpson was in fact involved in a domestic violence incident with Nicole Brown Simpson in 1989. This is going to become a further sticking point later on as the case evolves, as OJ will continue to attest that that was the only time any sort of incident had happened. However, as we know, that is not the truth. It was simply that was the only time that charges were laid against OJ for any form of physical violence against Nicole. There are numerous calls from the Simpson home in the years prior to that, during which officers arrived and nothing was done. Whether or not that is because Nicole refused to give them information, or because the officers were starstruck by O.J. Simpson, is really up to your interpretation. Both stories are out there for the majority of these calls, with some stories stating that the officers in fact received autographs from Simpson when they arrived at the house. Again, I cannot verify either one of those, but it is odd to me that there are, you know, over a dozen phone calls over the years to the Simpson home, and the only one where anything was done is this phone call from New Year's Eve 1989. While all of this is going down, Van Adder is completing his search warrant for O.J. Simpson's house on North Rockingham Drive. And it's at this point that the detectives make what is, in my opinion, the biggest mistake of this case. Normally how it works is the district attorney's office will assign a member of the district attorney prosecuting team to basically handle the case in the court of law and direct it once an arrest warrant, etc., has been turned over. That is not what happens here. Detective Lang reaches out to the district attorney's office and specifically Marcia Clark to help with the wording on the search warrant for Simpson's estate, basically selecting Marcia Clark as the prosecutor who is going to handle this case. Why is this a problem? It's my opinion, and people can argue with me till they're blue in the face. You're not going to change my opinion. Marcia Clark was woefully underqualified to handle the Simpson murder investigation and subsequent trial. And while that is my opinion, I think history has borne me out with this one. And you're going to see it as we get into the subsequent trial of O.J. Simpson. Clark had so many missteps and misopportunities and just a inability to stand up to the defense in any meaningful way. She's the reason why the O.J. Simpson ends up getting found not guilty. I know, spoiler alert, yeah, he doesn't get convicted. Because she was so ineffectual as a lead counsel. That's not stating that she was not a good lawyer, but that this case was beyond her, in my opinion. And you're going to see that even from the early stages of this investigation, Clark was not capable of handling such a big-time trial. I know she became a media darling for a period of time because of this trial, and that may be one of the reasons why she was so ineffectual, because she got, you know, wrapped up in the celebrity that ends up being bestowed upon her. I mean, you gotta understand, if you didn't live through this case when it was going on, there would be news breaks where they'd be discussing Marcia Clark's hairstyle and her mode of dress. This type of thing can fuck with somebody's mind, especially someone who's in a very high-stress situation, being pitted against some of the best criminal defense attorneys in the world. It's my opinion that that was the case with Marcia Clark. She got wrapped up in all of the BS and lost sight of the prize. Regardless, Van Atter is the one who makes the decision that Clark is going to be the district attorney that they are going to be dealing with moving forward. Now, the reason that Van Atter chose to go with Clark is because he had worked with her prior to this on two successful cases. So it is understandable that he would want to go with someone who is a proven winner. And I will concede that at this early stage in the case, there was no possible way for anyone involved to know just how gigantic the trial of O.J. Simpson was going to become and how all-encompassing it was going to be within American society. So Van Atter gives Clark a rundown of what's going on, reads her the search warrant, and Clark basically signs off on it, saying it sounds like you've got a pretty solid case for searching the Simpson estate. Van Atter takes the search warrant to Judge Linda Lefkowitz, who ends up signing it at 10:45 a.m. At South Bundy, the processing of the crime scene has continued, as has the media presence, which continues to swell as the officers investigate the crime scene. The SID team eventually arrives. However, the first on the scene at the Bundy crime scene is in fact the coroner's office, and this allows the detectives to actually begin to look at the bodies. Nicole Brown Simpson is lying on her left side in a semi-fetal position with her head pointing in a northeasterly direction. I'll remind you, I'm taking this directly from the notes of the officers, as well as the book that they put out covering the crimes, as well as the subsequent trial, Evidence Dismissed, the inside story of the people of California against O.J. Simpson. A portion of Nicole's legs were underneath a stationary gate pointing southward, with one leg resting against an exterior outlet. It's noted that there are blood smears on Nicole's outer right calf and thigh, as well as on her inner left knee and thigh. The right arm is beneath her body, while her left arm and hand, which are both smeared with blood, are extended outward. Fingernails were noted to be intact, but it was noted by Officer Lang that there was blood underneath Nicole's fingernails. There is a silver ring on her left thumb and another ring on her left ring finger. There's another ring as well as a watch on her wrist. Gold earrings. Nicole is barefoot, and the officers take note of the fact that the bottoms of her feet, the soles, are in fact clean of any sort of blood, which to them spells out that Nicole had been struck and then murdered, meaning she was knocked down and then fully assaulted. There is a very deep wound going from the center of her throat, the larynx area, over to her right ear, which nearly decapitated Nicole. Obviously, this is a fatal wound. They also note that there are blood splatters on Nicole's exposed back. This, again, would be a bone of contention during the trial because only a criminalist can collect this blood evidence. Unfortunately, the only criminalist that is currently available is over at the Rockingham crime scene, and it will be a while before this criminalist arrives. As a result of this, the blood on Nicole's back will have to be collected at the coroner's office. And again, this is something that the defense team can use during their case by stating that the blood was in fact not present, that the body was mishandled, and the blood that became present on her back was due to the mishandling of Nicole's body. Instead, a photograph is taken at the crime scene of the blood on Nicole's back, which will later be entered into evidence. The crime scene as well as the bodies are photographed from various different angles. There's also measurements taken. Crime scene investigation is a very arduous and time-consuming task. Now, Dennis Fung arrives at roughly 10:15. He's the criminalist from SID. Now he's there to begin the processing of this crime scene. It's just my opinion. It's odd to me that Fung would go to the North Rockingham estate prior to processing the actual main crime scene where the bodies were discovered, and I say that because the officers had already secured the crime scene at North Rockingham. They're getting the warrants, thus ensuring that O.J. Simpson and none of his associates can come onto the property and disturb anything or investigate anything. Instead, they chose to process that crime scene first before moving on to the South Bundy crime scene. I think that was a misstep in the investigation of this case. With Fung on site, they can actually begin a proper examination of her body on site, as well as the body of Ron Goldman. Nicole's body is then placed inside of a body bag and moved to the coroner's van. At 10:40, they take the liver temperature, which I had already discussed earlier in this episode, despite what you're told and you may read, is not an exact science. It's found that Nicole's liver temperature is 82 degrees, go back to Ron Goldman's body, which was 4 feet 10 inches to the north of where Nicole's body lay. He's lying on his right side with his torso bent at the waist, and his head is lying at the foot of a tree, pointed in a westerly direction. It's noted there are scrape marks on his face, as well as dried blood that has run down from his nose and left ear. It becomes apparent to the investigating officers that Ron Goldman was in a physical fight with the assailant prior to being murdered. His left leg is bent at a 90-degree angle, and it appears that his right leg has been severely lacerated. The shirt that he is wearing has been pulled up around his back. The officers would later speculate that this was evidence to them that the assailant had grabbed him from behind and yanked him back while twisting him in order to commit the act of murder upon him. The victim's throat was cut on both the left and right hand sides. However, neither wound is as vicious as the wound to Nicole Brown Simpson's throat. And we're going to point this out because, again, I'm going to bring this up in another episode. There is a doctor out there who believes that both victims were killed by separate entities, and that, in fact, two different knives were used in the commission of this crime. And when we get to that particular episode later on, we're going to get into it more. The doctor believes that both of the cuts to the throats were one single fluid motion, and that in fact the cuts on Goldman's throat were not two separate cuts, but one single cut that basically grazed over the larynx or Adam's apple area of his throat before plunging back in and cutting. There is another stab wound to his left thigh. The officers take note that the coroner accidentally moves evidence while attempting to collect Ron Goldman's body, specifically the blue knit cap and the white envelope that were found at the crime scene are moved in the process of this. Once his body is placed inside of the morgue wagon, the coroner removes the man's wallet, and it is discovered that he is 25-year-old Ronald Lyle Goldman, who is listed on his driver's license as being 6'1" and 170 pounds. And it's interesting to note that because the coroner identified him, it is the coroner's office's responsibility to identify Goldman's family of their loved one's murder. At 10:45, Goldman's beeper begins to go off, and officers make note of this, finding that the number belonged to a bartender at the Mezzaluna restaurant where Goldman worked. Again, Goldman's liver temperature is taken, after which he is further examined and defensive wounds are noted on his hands. The officers come to the conclusion that Goldman had not, in fact, struck his assailant with closed fists, but instead been flailing around frantically as he was assaulted. There is blood found on Goldman's left foot, which is later determined to be cast off either from the killer himself or from the weapon that the killer was wielding. The glove found at the crime scene is later determined to be an Aris Isotomer size extra large dark brown glove, cashmere lined, and later it would in fact be linked as the matching glove to the one found at the North Rockingham estate. Van Adder returns during some part of this after both bodies have been removed and informs Lang that Marcia Clark is going to be overseeing this case, which causes some bit of friction between the two men, as Lang is not exactly a fan of Marcia Clark, and given what we know now of this case, it's easy to see why. And after all of this, Van Adder returns to North Rockingham while Lang continues to process the crime scene. Now, when Van Adder arrives back at Simpson's estate around noon, he is dismayed to note that major media outlets have already begun to descend on the scene. This is because the media was able to ascertain who it was that had been killed at South Bundy, and very easily they were able to come to the conclusion that the police may suspect her ex-husband as having been involved and or responsible for Nicole Brown Simpson's murder. Now, upon arriving at the Rockingham estate, Van Adder quickly realizes that Simpson's Bronco is still parked out on the street in front of the property. This is a major issue, as he had ordered the Bronco to be towed to the impound lot hours earlier. He then talks to some of the officers on site and informs them that he has the search warrant and will now begin conducting his search of the home, and that they need to make certain that the property remains secure with no unauthorized personnel coming in or out. It's during this conversation that a defense attorney by the name of Howard Weitzman arrives and informs Van Adder that he has been contacted by O.J. Simpson and that Simpson has asked Weitzman to meet him at the Rockingham property. After speaking with him, Van Adder heads into the house where another officer meets him. And they begin to discuss the logistics of going through the entire house, looking for various things connected to the crime that has taken place over at South Bundy. Now, while this is going on, both men are distracted by what is later said to be a commotion outside. Heading outdoors, Van Adder is startled and angry to see O.J. Simpson, who has been placed in handcuffs after attempting to gain access to the property. Obviously, the media is going wild at this sight, videotaping and snapping pictures of this. Van Adder is able to get the situation calmed down by having the handcuffs removed from Simpson. So leaving the other officers to conduct the search, which unfortunately, my personal opinion, I believe Van Adder should have stayed at the Rockingham estate and conducted the search himself, because as we're going to find out, there is evidence that is overlooked and not taken. Van Adder instead decides to speak with Simpson and convinces him rather easily to come downtown and speak with him and other officers, which OJ again agrees to do. He does this of his own volition against the advice of his attorney. So Simpson is brought to the precinct by Van Adder at roughly 12:10 p.m. According to Van Adder, he intentionally avoided using the term suspect while speaking to O.J. Simpson, and it was in fact Simpson himself who sarcastically referred to himself as the number one suspect. And Van Adder would later note in his report that other than this statement and some quick replies, Simpson never asked what happened to his ex-wife. All this is going on, Lang has been informed that Simpson has voluntarily come down to the police precinct, and as he's making ready to leave, he is confronted by a man named Joe DiBella, who's the manager of the Mezzaluna Trattoria restaurant, which Nicole Brown Simpson had visited with her family the previous evening. And this is the notes that Lang took. Quote, the witness states that he has observed O.J. Simpson and victim Brown at the restaurant in the past on at least one occasion. The witness went on to state that both victims frequented the Mark Stevens Gym on St. Vicente near the restaurant on 6-12-94 at approximately 1900 hours. The victim Brown came to the restaurant with a party of 10. They had reservations. In conversation, victim Goldman states to the witness that he had been seeing victim Brown socially. The Brown party left the restaurant at approximately 2100 hours. Victim Goldman left the restaurant at approximately 2145-2150 hours. Prior to Goldman's departure, the witness admonished Goldman to use caution in his relationship with Nicole Brown. The witness feels that if Goldman listened to the advice, he seemed not affected by it. At 12:45 p.m., Simpson and Van Adder arrive at the police precinct. Not long after this, Van Adder gets Simpson a Pepsi, and Weitzman arrives with Skiff, Taft, and Lang not far behind. Weitzman does inform the officers that this really isn't his type of a case, but does request time to speak with Simpson, which the officers grant. While this is going on, Lang and Van Adder compare notes, and Lang points out to Van Adder that Simpson has a large bandage on the middle finger of his left hand. Van Adder had not noticed it, and it's decided that should they be allowed to interview Simpson, they will question him about this. After Simpson's lawyers exit the interview room, they speak with the officers and inform them that they are going to be allowed to interview Simpson despite their misgivings on this. Not only that, they're going to be allowed to interview Simpson without his lawyers present. Any criminal defense attorney and many officers will tell you that you never speak to the police, no matter what the situation is, because they will turn your words around against you and use them against you. Even with lawyers present, it is never a good idea to talk with the police. Simpson ends up doing this. Now, this could be because he legitimately is not responsible for the crime that took place on South Bundy, or it could be that his ego is so large that he believes that he can bullshit his way out of it. In any event, Van Adder and Lang do end up speaking with O.J. Simpson. At 1:32 p.m. on June 13th, 1994, the officers began to talk with O.J. Simpson. Now, his lawyers had requested that the conversation between Simpson and the detectives be recorded, and the officers were all too willing to accommodate them with this. This is how we know what, in fact, was said inside of the room. The officers read O.J. Simpson his Miranda rights, which he states that he understands. Now we're going to read the transcript of this interview, which began at 1:35 p.m. Van Adder. We're in an interview room in Parker Center. The date is June 13th, 1994, and we're here with O.J. Simpson. Is that Orenthal James Simpson? Simpson. Orenthal James Simpson. Van Adder. And what is your date of birth, Mr. Simpson? Simpson. July 9th, 1947. Van Adder. Okay, prior to us talking to you, as we agreed with your attorney, I'm going to give you your constitutional rights, and I would like you to listen carefully. If you don't understand anything, tell me, okay? Simpson, yes. Van Adder, okay, Mr. Simpson, you have the right to remain silent. If you give up the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. If you have the right to speak with an attorney and to have an attorney present during questioning, if you so desire and cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you without charge before questioning. Do you understand your rights? Simpson, yes, I do. Van Adder, are there any questions about that? Simpson, no. Van Adder, okay, do you wish to give up your right to remain silent and talk to us? Simpson, yes. Van Adder, Okay, we're investigating, obviously, the death of your ex-wife and another man. Simpson, someone told us that. Van Etter, yeah, and we're going to need to talk to you about that. Are you divorced from her now? Simpson, yes. Van Etter, how long have you been divorced? Simpson, officially probably close to 2 years, but we've been apart for a little over 2 years. Van Etter, have you? What was your relationship with her? What was the... Simpson, well, we tried to get back together and it just didn't work. It wasn't working and so we were both going our separate ways. Van Etter, recently you tried to get back together? Simpson, we tried to get back together for about a year, you know, where we started dating each other and seeing each other. She came back and wanted us to get back together and... Van Etter, within the last year you're talking about? Simpson, she came back about a year and 4 months ago about us trying to get back together, and we gave it a shot. We gave it a shot the better part of a year, and I think we both knew it wasn't working, and probably 3 weeks ago or so, we said it just wasn't working, and we went our separate ways. Van Etter, okay, the two children are yours? Simpson, yes. Lang, does she have custody? Simpson, yeah. We both have joint custody, but she has, Lang, it's already been brought through the courts? Simpson, we went through the courts and everything. Everything is done. We have no problems with the kids. We do things together, you know, with the kids. Van Etter, how was your separation? Simpson, the first separation? Van Etter, yeah, were there problems with that? Simpson, for me, it was big problems. I loved her. I didn't want us to separate. Van Etter, uh-huh. I understand that she had made a couple of crime reports, some warning crime reports or something. Simpson, we had a big fight about 6 years ago on New Year's. You know, she made a report, I didn't make a report, and then we had an altercation about a year ago maybe. It wasn't a physical argument, I kicked her door or something. Van Etter, and she made a police report on these two occasions? Simpson, mm-hmm, and I stayed right there until the police came, talked to them. Lang, were you arrested at one time for something? Simpson, no. I mean, 5 years ago we had a big fight. 6 years ago, I don't know. I know I ended up doing community service. Lang, so you were arrested? Simpson, no, I was never really arrested. Lang, they never booked you in or anything like that? Simpson, no, no. Lang, can I ask, what's the last time you slept? Simpson, I got a couple hours of sleep last night. I mean, you know, I slept a little on the plane... Not much, and when I got to the hotel, I was asleep a few hours when the phone call came. Lang, did Nicole have a housemaid that lived there? Simpson, I believe so, yes. Lang, do you know her name at all? Simpson, Avia, Alvia, Avia, something like that. Lang, we didn't see her there. Did she have the day off, perhaps? Simpson, I don't know. I don't know what schedule she had her on. Lang, okay, Phil, what do you think? We can just maybe recount last night? Van Etter, yeah, when was the last time you saw Nicole, OJ? Simpson, we were leaving the dance recital. She took off and I was talking to her parents. Van Etter, where was the dance recital? Simpson, Paul Revere School. Van Etter, and was that for one of your children? Simpson, yeah, for my daughter, Sydney. Van Etter, and what time was that yesterday? Simpson, it ended about 6:30, quarter to 7, you know, something like that. I, you know, in the ballpark right in that area, and they took off. Van Etter, they? Simpson, her and her family, her mother and father, her sisters, my kids. Van Etter, your children, and then you went your own separate ways? Simpson, yeah, actually she left, and then they came back, and her mother got in a car with her, and the kids all piled into her sister's car, and they... Van Etter, was Nicole driving? Simpson, yeah. Van Etter, what kind of car was she driving? Simpson, her black car, a Cherokee. Van Etter, Cherokee? Simpson, Jeep Cherokee. Van Etter, what were you driving? Simpson, my Rolls Royce, my Bentley, rather. Van Etter, do you own the Ford Bronco that sits outside? Simpson, Hertz owns it, and you know, Hertz let me use it. Van Etter, so that's your vehicle, the one that was parked there on the street? Simpson, mm-hmm, yeah. Van Etter, and it's actually owned by Hertz? Simpson, Hertz, yeah. Van Etter, who's the primary driver on that, you? Simpson, I drive it, the housekeeper drives it, you know, it's kind of a...
Van Adder all-purpose type vehicle, Simpson all-purpose type, yeah. It's the only one that my insurance would allow me to let anybody else drive. Van Adder, okay. Lang, when you drive it, where do you park it at home? Simpson, it depends, all kinds of. Lang, where is it now? It was in the street or something? Simpson, always park it on the street. Lang, you never take it in behind the. Simpson, oh, rarely, I mean. I'll bring it in after I come from golf and switch stuff, you know. And stuff like that, you know. I did that yesterday. Lang, when did you last drive it? Simpson, yesterday. Van Adder, what time yesterday? Simpson, in the morning, in the afternoon. Van Adder, okay, you left her. You're saying about 6:30 or 7. You or she left the recital? Simpson, yeah. Van Adder, and you spoke with her parents? Simpson, yeah, we were just sitting there talking. Van Adder, okay, what time did you leave the recital? Simpson, right about that time, we were all leaving. We were all leaving then, and they, her mother said something about me joining them for dinner, and I said, no thanks. Van Adder, where did you go from there, OJ? Simpson, home for a while, got in my car for a while, tried to find my girlfriend for a while, came back to the house. Van Adder, who was home when you got there? Simpson, Cato. Van Adder, Cato, anybody else? Was your daughter there? Arnell? Simpson, no. Van Adder, isn't that her name, Arnell? Simpson, Arnell, yeah. Van Adder, so what time do you think you got back home, actually physically got home? Simpson, 7-something. Van Adder, 7-something? Simpson, yeah. Van Adder, and then you left and... Simpson, yeah, I'm trying to think. Did I leave, you know? I'm always, you know, I had to run and get my daughter some flowers. That was actually during the recital, so I rushed and got her some flowers, and then I came home, and then I called Paula as I was going to her house, and Paula wasn't home. Van Adder, Paula is your girlfriend? Simpson, girlfriend, yeah. Van Adder, Paula who? Simpson, Barbary. Van Adder, could you spell that for me? Simpson, Barbieri. Van Adder, do you know have an address on her? Simpson, no, she lives on Wilshire, but I think she's out of town. Lang, you got a phone number? Van Adder, so you didn't see her last night? Simpson, no, we'd been to a big affair the night before, and then I came back home. I was basically at home. I mean, any time I was... Whatever time it took me to get to the recital and back, to get to the flower shop and back, I mean, that's the time I was out of the house. Van Adder, were you scheduled to play golf this morning someplace? Simpson, in Chicago. Van Adder, in Chicago, what kind of tournament was this? Simpson, it's Hertz, with clients, special clients, Lang. Oh, okay, well, what's the whole thing with Hertz? Simpson, yeah. Van Adder, what time did you leave last night, leave the house? Simpson, to go to the airport? Van Adder, mm-hmm. Simpson, about the limo was supposed to be there at 10:45. Normally they get there a little earlier. I was rushing around and somewhere between there and 11 o'clock. Van Adder, so approximately 10:45 to 11? Simpson, 11 o'clock here, somewhere in that area. Van Adder, and you went by limo? Simpson, yeah. Van Adder, who's the limo service? Simpson, I don't know. You have to ask my office. Lang, did you converse with the driver at all? Did you talk to him? Simpson, yeah, he's a new driver. Probably. Normally, I have a regular driver I drive with that converses. Lang, remember his name? Simpson, no. Just about rushing to the airport, about how I live my life on airplanes and hotel food and so on, that type of thing. Lang, what time did your plane leave? Simpson, 11:45, the plane took off. Van Adder, what airline was it? Simpson, American. Van Adder, American, and it was 11:45 to Chicago? Simpson, Chicago. Lang, so yesterday you did drive the white Bronco? Simpson, mm-hmm. Lang, and where did you park it when you brought it home? Simpson, the first time probably by the mailbox. I'm trying to think, or did I bring it in the driveway? Normally I will park it by the mailbox. Sometimes I will... Lang, on Ashford or Ashland? Simpson, on Ashford, yeah. Lang, where did you park it yesterday for the last time, do you remember? Simpson, right where it is. Lang, where is it now? Simpson, yeah. Lang, where on? Simpson, right on the street there. Lang, on Ashford? Simpson, no, on Rockingham. Lang, you parked it there? Simpson, yes. Lang, about what time was that? Simpson, 8-something, 7, 8, 9 o'clock? I don't know, right in that area.
It's important to note here that Simpson is already starting to change his story. If you remember when I began reading the transcript, Simpson stated that he had driven it only in the morning. Now he's stating that he had, in fact, parked it out on Rockingham during the night. Obviously, the officers picked up on this inconsistency immediately and made a mental note of it. However, since this wasn't an official interrogation, they weren't going to press OJ about it too heavily. Continuing on, Lang, did you take it to the recital? Simpson, no. Lang, what time was the recital? Simpson, over at about 6:30. Like I said, I came home, I got my car, I was going to see my girlfriend, I was calling her and she wasn't around. Van Adder, so you drove the... You come home in the... And then you got in the Bronco? Simpson, in the Bronco, because my phone was in the Bronco, and because it's a Bronco, it's a Bronco, it's what I drive, you know? I'd rather drive it than any other car, and I, you know, and as I was going over there, I called her a couple of times, and she wasn't there, and I left a message, and then I checked my messages, and she had left a message that she wasn't there, and that she may have to leave town, and then I came back and ended up sitting with Cato. Interesting and of note that later on during his deposition for the civil trial that followed the criminal trial, Simpson would state that he was unaware that Barbary had left him a message. But I digress. Lang, okay, and about what time was this again that you parked the Bronco? Simpson, 8-something, maybe? Lang, inaudible. Simpson, relatively, he hadn't done a jacuzzi, we hadn't gone, we went and got a burger, and I come home and kind of leisurely got ready to go, you know, I mean, we had done a few things after this. Lang, you weren't in a hurry when you came back with the white Bronco? Simpson, no. Lang, the reason I asked you, the cars were parked kind of at a funny angle that stuck out in the street. Simpson, well, it's part because I don't know if it's a funny angle or what. It's part because when I was hustling at the end of the day to get all my stuff and I was getting my phone and everything off it, I was just, when I pulled, you know, bring it out of the gate there, it's just, it's a tight turn. Lang, so you had it inside the compound then? Simpson, yeah. Lang, oh, okay. Van Adder, OJ, what's... Simpson, I brought it inside the compound to get my stuff out of it, you know, and then I put it out and I'd run back in the gate before the gate closes. Van Adder, OJ, what's your office phone number? Van Adder, how did you get the injury on your hand? Simpson, I don't know. At the first time, I know I had it when I was in Chicago and all, but at the house I was just running around. Van Adder, how did you do it in Chicago? Simpson, I broke a glass. One of you guys had just called me, and I was in the bathroom, and I just kind of went bonkers for a little bit. Lang, is that how you cut it? Simpson, it was cut before, but I think I just opened it again. I don't know. I'm not sure, because going there... Lang, do you recall? Simpson, pardon me? Lang, do you recall bleeding at all in your truck, in your Bronco? Simpson, I recall bleeding at my house, and then I went to the Bronco. The last thing I did before I left, when I was rushing, was went and got my phone out of the Bronco. This, too, is important because, as you'll recall, Simpson has just stated that he was leisurely getting things ready for his trip, but now he has changed that to he's rushing around. Lang, Simpson, whatever that is. Lang, where's the phone now? Simpson, in my bag. Lang, oh, you have it? Simpson, right in that black bag. Lang, you brought a bag with you here? Simpson, well, yeah, it's in my car. I left it in my car. Lang, so do you recall bleeding at all? Simpson, yeah. I mean, I knew I was bleeding, but it was no big deal. I bleed all the time. I mean, I play golf and stuff, so there's always something, nicks and stuff here and there. Lang, so did you do anything? When did you put the Band-Aid on it? Simpson, actually asked the girl this morning for it. Lang, in Chicago? Simpson, yeah, because last night I just put a... When Cato and I was leaving, he was saying something to me, and I was rushing to get my phone, and I put a little thing on it, and it stopped. Lang, do you have the keys to that Bronco? Simpson, yeah. Lang, okay. We've impounded the Bronco. I don't know if you knew that or not. Simpson, no, that's fine. Lang,
take a look at it other than you. Who's the last person to drive it? Simpson. Probably Gigi. When I'm out of town, I don't know who drives the car. Maybe my daughter, maybe Kato Lang. The keys are available. Simpson. I leave the keys there, you know, when Gigi's there, because sometimes she needs it, or Gigi was off and wasn't coming back until today, and I was coming back tonight. Lang, so you don't mind if Gigi uses it, or... Simpson, this is the only one I can let her use. When she doesn't have her car, or sometimes her husband takes her car, I let her use the Bronco. Lang, when was the last time you were at Nicole's house? Simpson, I don't go in. I won't. I don't go in her house. I haven't been in her house in, well, a week, maybe 5 days. I go to her house a lot. I'm always there. I'm dropping the kids off, picking the kids up, fooling around with the dog, you know. Lang, how does that usually work? Do you drop them at the porch, or do you go in with them? Simpson, no, I don't go in the house. I go... Lang, that electronic gate out front? Simpson, yeah. Lang, but you never go inside the house? Simpson, up until about 5 days, 6 days ago, I haven't been in the house. Once I started seeing Paula again, I kind of avoid Nicole. Lang, is Nicole seeing anybody else that you know? Simpson, I have no idea. I really... have absolutely no idea. I don't ask her. I don't know. Her and her girlfriends, they go out, you know. They've got some things going on right now with her girlfriends, and so I'm assuming something's happening because one of the girlfriends is having a big problem with her husband because she's always saying she's with Nicole until 3 or 4 in the morning. She's not, you know. Nicole tells me she leaves her at 1:30 or 2 or 2:30, and the girl doesn't get home until 5, and she only lives a few blocks away. Van Adder, something's going on, huh? Simpson, yeah. Lang, do you know where they went, the family, for dinner that last night? Simpson, no, well, I didn't ask. Lang, I just thought maybe there's a regular place that you go. Simpson, no. If I was with them, we'd go to Toscano, I mean, not Toscano, Paponi's. Van Adder, you haven't had any problems with her lately, have you, OJ? Simpson, I always have problems with her, you know? Our relationship has been a problem relationship. It's probably late me for me, and I say this only because I said it to Ron yesterday at Ron Fishman, whose wife is Cora, at the dance recital when he came up to me and went, oh boy, what's going on? And everybody was beefing with everybody, and I said, well, hey man, I'm just glad I'm out of the mix, you know, because I was like dealing with him and his problems with his wife and Nicole, and with evidently some new problem that a guy named Christian was having with his girl, and he was staying at Nicole's house, and something was going on, but I don't think it's pertinent to this. Van Adder, did she have words with you last night? Simpson, pardon me. Van Adder, did Nicole have words with you last night? Simpson, no, not at all. Van Adder, did you talk to her last night? Simpson, to ask to speak to my daughter, to congratulate my daughter and everything, because they're out of there. So, Van Adder, but you didn't have a conversation with her? Simpson, no, no. Van Adder, what were you wearing last night, OJ? Simpson, what did I wear on the golf course yesterday? Some of these kinds of pants, I mean, I changed different for the whatever it was. I just had on some, what do you call these? Van Adder, just these black pants? Simpson, yeah, they're called Bugle Boy. Van Adder, Bugle Boy, is that what you wore to the recital? Simpson, no, no, to the recital I wore, what did I wear to the recital? I wore a white t-shirt and some slacks and stuff. Lang, these aren't the pants? Simpson, no. Lang, okay, where are the pants that you... Simpson, they're hanging in my closet, you know? Lang, these are washable, right? You just throw them in the laundry? Simpson, yeah, I got 100 pair. They give them to me free, Bugle Boys, so I've got a bunch of them. Lang, do you recall coming back and hanging them up, or... Simpson, I always hang up my clothes. I mean, it's rare that I don't hang up my clothes unless I'm going to lay them in my bathroom for her to do something with them, you know? Those are the only... that I don't hang up, but something... when you play golf, you don't necessarily dirty pants, you know? They get holes. Van Adder, what kind of shoes were you wearing? Simpson, tennis shoes. Van Adder... tennis shoes, do you know what kind? Simpson, probably Reebok, that's all I wear. Lang, are they at home too? Simpson, yeah. Lang, was this just to be a short trip to Chicago so you didn't take a whole lot? Simpson, yeah, I was coming back today. Lang, just overnight? Simpson, yeah, gonna play golf today. Van Adder, that's a hectic schedule, drive back here to play golf and then come back. Simpson, yeah, but I do it all the time. Van Adder, do you? Simpson, yeah, that's why I was complaining with the driver about, you know, about how my whole life is on and off airplanes. Van Adder, OJ, we've got sort of a problem. Simpson. Mm-hmm. Van Adder, we've got some blood on and in your car. We've got some blood at your house and sort of a problem. Simpson. Well, we'll take my blood test and you'll see. Lang. Well, we'd like to do that. We got, of course, the cut on your finger that you aren't real clear on. Simpson. Can't be any clearer than I am. Lang. Okay, do you recall having that cut on your finger the last time you were at Nicole's house? Simpson. A week ago? Lang. Yeah. Simpson. No, I'm pretty sure, yeah, it was last night. Lang. Okay, so it's last night you cut it? Simpson. Yeah, yeah. Van Adder. Somewhere after the recital? Simpson. Somewhere when I was rushing to get to my house. Again, we have Simpson stating that he was rushing to get to his house to leave for Chicago. Again, another contradiction from his initial statement. Van Adder, somewhere after recital? Simpson, somewhere when I was rushing to get out of my house. Van Adder, okay, after the recital? Simpson, yeah. Lang, what do you think happened? Do you have any idea? Simpson, I have no idea, man. Lang, has she been getting threatening phone calls? Simpson, you guys haven't told me anything. I have no idea what happened. When you said to my daughter, who said something to me today, that somebody else might have been involved, I have absolutely no idea what happened. I don't know how, why, or what, but you guys haven't told me everything. Every time I ask you guys, you say you're going to tell me in a bit. This is an important statement from Simpson because, as already noted numerous times, both detectives would later state in their reports and under oath that at no point did Simpson ever ask them what actually had happened to Nicole Brown Simpson. Van Adder, well, we don't have a lot of the answers to these questions yet ourselves, OJ, okay? Simpson, I've got a bunch of guns. I've got guns all over the place, you know. You can take them. They're all there. I mean, you can see them. I keep them in my car for an incident that happened a month ago that my in-laws, my wife, and everybody knows about, you know. Lang, what was that? Simpson, going down to, and cops come down there, know all about it because I've told two marshals about it at a mall. I was going down for a christening, and I just left our seat, and it was like 3:30 in the morning, and I'm in a lane, and also the car in front of me is going real slow, and I'm going real slow. I figure he sees a cop because we were all going pretty fast, and I'm going to change lanes, but there's a car next to me, and I can't change lanes. Then that goes for a while. Now I'm going to slow down and go around him, but the car butts up to me, and I'm like caught between three cars. They were Oriental guys. And they were not letting me go anywhere. And finally, I went on the shoulder and I sped up, and then I held my phone up so they could see the light part of it. You know, because I have tinted windows and they kind of scattered, and I chased one of them for a while to make him think I was chasing him before I took off. Lang, were you in the Bronco? Simpson, no. Lang, what were you driving? Simpson, my Bentley, has tinted windows and all, so I figured they thought they had a nice little touch. Lang, did you think they were trying to rip you off, maybe? Was that it? Simpson, I thought definitely they were. And then the next thing you know, I was Nicole and I, you know, I went home, I got real, I got, at 4 in the morning, I got down there to Laguna, and when we woke up, I told her about it and told her parents about it, told everybody about it, you know? And when I saw two marshals at my mall, I walked up and told them about it. Lang, what did they do? Make a report and all? Simpson, they didn't do nothing. I mean, they'll remember me and remember I told them. Lang, did Nicole mention that she'd been getting any threats lately to you? Anything she was concerned about or the kid's safety? Simpson, to her? Lang, yes. Simpson, from? Lang, from anybody. Simpson, no, not at all. Lang, was she very security conscious? Did she keep that house locked up? Simpson, very. Lang, I know the intercom didn't work apparently, right? Simpson, I thought it worked. Lang, oh, okay, does the electronic buzzer work on the gate? Simpson, the electronic buzzer worked to let people in. Lang, do you ever park in the rear when you go over there? Simpson, most of the times. Something else that stands out to the detectives as it's their belief at this point, just based on the visual evidence that they've seen, that the killer more probably than not parked in the rear of the house. Lang, you park in the rear? Simpson, most of the time when I'm taking the kids there, I come right in the driveway, blow the horn, and she a lot of the times, or the housekeeper, either the housekeeper opens, or they'll keep a garage door opened up on top of the thing, you know, and make that. But yes, when I'm dropping the kids off and stuff, when I'm going in, and then sometimes I go in to the front because the kids have to hit the buzzer and stuff. Van Adder, did you say before that up until about 3 weeks ago, you guys were going out again and trying to reconcile? Simpson, no, we've been going out for about a year, and then the last 6 months we've had, it ain't been working, so we tried various things to see if we can make it work. We started trying to date, and it wasn't working, and so, you know, then we just said the hell with it, you know? Van Adder, and that was about 3 weeks ago. Simpson, yeah, and about 3 weeks ago, it was like we just stopped. Van Adder, so you were seeing her up to that point? Simpson, to say I was seeing her, yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah, we were trying. It was like it was a done deal. It just wasn't happening, you know? I was gone. I mean, I was in San Juan doing a film, and I don't think we had sex since I've been back from San Juan, and that was like 2 months ago, so it's been like, for the kids, we tried to do things together. We didn't go out together, you know? We didn't really date each other. Then we decided, let's try to date each other. We went out one night, and it just didn't work, you know? Van Adder, when you say it didn't work, what do you mean? Simpson, the night we went out, it was fun. Then the next night we went out, it was actually when I was down in Laguna, and she didn't want to go out, and I said, well, let's go out, because I came all the way down here to go out, and we kind of had a beef, and it just didn't work after that, you know? We were only trying to date to see if we could bring some romance back into our relationship. We just said, let's treat each other like boyfriend and girlfriend instead of, you know, like 17-year-old married people. I mean, 17 years together, whatever that is. Lang, how long were you together? Simpson, 17 years. Lang, 17 years. Van Adder, did you ever hit her, OJ? Simpson, one night we had a fight. That night we had a fight. Hey, she hit me, you know? And as I said, they never took my statement. They never wanted to hear my side, and they never wanted to hear the housekeeper's side. Nicole was drunk. She did her thing. She started tearing up my house, you know? And I didn't punch her or anything, but I, you know, Van Adder, slapped her a couple of times. Simpson, no, I wrestled her, is what I did. I didn't slap her at all. I mean, I wrestled her. You know, Cole's a strong girl. She's one of the most conditioned women. Since that period of time, she's hit me a few times, but I've never touched her after that, and I'm telling you, it's 5-6 years ago. That's a statement that is also going to come back to bite Simpson on the ass, as the detectives are going to be able to get their hands on the original police report, as well as photographs of Nicole Brown Simpson, who it's apparent is heavily battered. Lang, what is her birth date? Simpson, May 19th. Lang, did you get together with her on her birthday? Simpson, yeah, her and I and the kids, I believe. Lang, did you give her a gift? Lang, I gave her a gift. Lang, what did you give her? Simpson, I gave her either the bracelet or the earrings. Lang, did she keep them or did she return them? Simpson, oh no, when we split, she gave me both the earrings and the bracelet back. I bought her a very nice bracelet. I don't know if it was a Mother's Day or a birthday, and I bought her earrings for the other thing. And when we split and it take credit to her, she felt that it wasn't right that she had it, and I said, good, because I want them back. Lang, was that the very day of her birthday, May 19th, or was it a few days later? Simpson, what do you mean? Lang, you gave it to her on the 19th of May, her birthday, right? This bracelet or earrings? Simpson, may I have given her the earrings? No, the bracelet, May 19th. When was Mother's Day? Lang, well, Mother's Day was around that time. Simpson, no, it was probably her birthday, yes. Lang, and did she return it the same day? Simpson, oh no, she I got into a funny place here on this, all right? She returned it, both of them. I mean, I took 3 weeks ago or so, because when I said I'm in a funny place on this, it was because I gave it to my girlfriend and told her it was for her, and that was 3 weeks ago. Told her I bought it for her, you know? What am I going to do with it? Lang, did Mr. Weitzman, your lawyer, your attorney, talk to you anything about this polygraph we brought up before? What about your thoughts on it? Simpson, should I talk about my thoughts on that? Lang, I mean, it's up to you. Simpson, I'm sure eventually I'll do it, but it's like, hey, I got some weird thoughts now, and I've got weird thoughts, you know, when you've been with a person for 17 years, you think everything, and I don't. I've got to understand what this thing is. I don't, you know, if it's true blue, I don't mind doing it. Lang, Well, you're not compelled at all to take this thing, number one. Number two, I don't know if Mr. Weitzman explained it to you. This goes to the exclusion of someone as much as the inclusion. Simpson, now you do that too, yeah? Yeah? Lang, now, and then we do that to eliminate people and just to get things straight. But does it work for elimination? Lang, oh yes, we use it for elimination more than anything else. Simpson, well, I'll talk to him about it. Lang, understand, the reason we're talking to you because you're the ex-husband. Simpson, I know, I'm the number one target, and now you're telling me I've got blood all over the place. Lang, well, there's blood at your house in the driveway, and that footstep, we've got a search warrant, we're going to go and get the blood, we found some in your house. Van Adder, is that your blood that's dripped there? Simpson, if it's dripped, it's what I dripped running around trying to leave. Van Adder, last night, Simpson, yeah, and I wasn't aware that it was. I was aware that I, and I was trying to get out of the house. I didn't even pay any attention to it. I saw it when I was in the kitchen, and I grabbed a napkin or something, and that was it. I didn't think about it after that. Van Adder, that was last night after you got home from the recital when you were rushing? Simpson, that was last night when I was, I don't know what I was. I was in the car getting my junk out of the car. I was in the house. I was throwing hangers and stuff in my suitcase. I was going, my little crazy what I do. I mean, I do it everywhere. Anybody who has ever picked me up says that OJ's a whirlwind at the end. He's running, he's grabbing things, and that what I was doing. Van Adder, well, I'm going to step out and I'm going to get a photographer to come down and photograph your hand there, and then pretty soon we're going to take you downstairs and get some blood from you. Simpson, okay. Van Adder, okay, I'll be right back. At this point, Van Adder leaves and Lang stays with OJ. Lang, so it was about 5 days ago you last saw Nicole. Was it at the house? Simpson, okay, the last time I saw Nicole, Jesus. Physically saw Nicole, I saw her obviously last night. The time before, I'm trying to even think. I went to Washington, D.C., so I didn't see her, so I'm trying to think. I haven't seen her since I went to Washington. I went to Washington. What's the date today? I mean, today is Monday, right? Lang, today's Monday the 13th of June. Simpson, okay, I went to Washington on maybe Wednesday. Thursday, I was in Connecticut. Then Long Island, Thursday afternoon and all of Friday. I got home Friday night, Friday afternoon. I played, you know, Paula picked me up, I believe, at the airport. I played golf Saturday, and when I came home, I think my son was there, so I did something with my son. I don't think I saw Nicole at all then, and then I went to a big affair with Paula Saturday night, and I got up and played golf Sunday, which pissed Paula off, and I saw Nicole at, so it was about a week before I saw her at the, you know, Lang, okay, and the last time you saw Nicole was at her house? Simpson, I don't remember. I wasn't in her house, so it couldn't have been at her house. So it was, you know, I don't physically remember the last time I saw her. I may have seen her even jogging one day. Lang, let me get this straight. You've never physically been inside the house? Simpson, not in the last week. Lang, ever. I mean, how long has she lived there? About 6 months? Simpson, oh Christ, I've slept at the house for many, many, many times, you know? I've done everything at the house, you know? I'm just saying in the last, you're talking in the last week or so. Lang, well, whatever. 6 months she's lived there? Simpson, I don't know, roughly. Last week I was at her house maybe 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago. One night, her and I had a long talk, you know, about, you know, how we can make it better for the kids and how we can do things better, you know? And okay, I can almost say when that was. That was when I don't know. It was about 10 days ago. And then I had her, the next day I had her dog do a flea bath or something with me. Oh, I'll tell you, I did see her one day. One day I went, I don't know if this was the early part of last week, I went because my son had to go and get something, and he ran in, and she came to the gate, and the dog ran out, and her friend, Faye, and I went looking for the dog. That may have been a week ago, I don't know. Lang, to Van Adder, who has returned. Got a photographer coming? Van Adder, no, we're going to take him up there. Lang, we're ready to terminate this at 14:07. After this, the officers take Simpson to get photographed. Simpson also voluntarily gives a vial of blood. By the time all of this is done, they get back. It's roughly 3:30 in the afternoon. where they are met by Simpson's lawyers. The officers try and get Simpson to continue speaking with them, that it's apparent that Simpson is done having any conversations with them, despite the fact that officers are still processing Simpson's North Rockingham home. The officers then go into their captain's office, this is Captain Gartland, and go over everything that Simpson has said to them, as well as what they discovered at both crime scenes. And it's at this point that the two officers officially state that they believe O.J. Simpson is responsible for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. They also learn that the car Goldman had borrowed was discovered near Nicole Brown Simpson's house on Dorothy Street, and that its owner is currently in Canada, along with information from the Chicago Police Department, who, through arrangements from the officers, have seized Simpson's room at the O'Hare Plaza Hotel, specifically room. The Chicago Police Department verifies Simpson's claim that he had broken a glass while in the room, which is apparently found in the sink, although there is no blood present on the glass or in the immediate vicinity. It's further stated, though, that blood stains are found on the bedding on which Simpson slept, as well as on one of the hotel towels. Later, the police are going to find out that after receiving the initial phone call from the police, Simpson had made a total of 48 calls from his cell phone between 6:41 and 11:15 a.m., with 18 of those calls going to Simpson's personal assistant, Skip Taft. The officers head over to the North Rockingham estate at roughly 4:30 with Van Adder, who has had possession of Simpson's travel bag since Simpson decided to come with them at noon, sees the bag and goes through it quickly looking for any evidence. However, he finds none. At 5:17, Van Adder arrives back at the North Rockingham estate, and he is dismayed to discover that a literal media circus has become encamped outside of Simpson's home. This is not the first, but it is the largest red flag the officers are going to have as to just how big and all-encompassing the case that they now find themselves is about to become. After getting through the throng of reporters, Van Adder hands over the blood sample that has been taken from Simpson to members of the crime scene analysis team. After this, Van Adder takes control again of the North Rockingham scene, where the search is ongoing. It should be noted that no weapons are found anywhere inside of or around the home. 17 items are removed by the SID team for analysis, many of which pertain to blood stain evidence found at the Simpson home. However, items not pertaining to blood stain evidence, at least not apparent at the start, include an airline ticket, a pair of navy blue socks that were found in the master bedroom, a blue plastic bag, a Marlboro cigarette butt, a tag apparently from a piece of clothing. While all this is going on, Lang has made his way into the house and up to the master bedroom, where he encounters Simpson, who asks if the officers have discovered a large cache of checks and money that Simpson keeps in the closet. He is informed that anything that has been taken from the home will be listed on an inventory, which will be provided to Simpson. He again asks Simpson what he was wearing the previous night. Simpson responds by telling him the same thing he said during his interview, which is a white t-shirt and a pair of slacks. He's then pressed about the shoes he was wearing. Simpson says that he believes he was wearing a pair of Reeboks, which he points out to Lang inside of the closet. Lang picks them up and notices what appears to be red stains on the shoes and informs Simpson that they will be taking these shoes. Lang also would later note that the shoes appeared to be about the same size as the footprints that were found at the South Bundy house. At roughly 7:10, Lang officially leaves the crime scene, taking the pair of Reeboks with him. This is important to note because every piece of evidence in the case needs to have an established chain of custody, and Lang holds on to these shoes at least until the next day, when they can get a case number for the Simpson / Goldman murder and officially turn the shoes in. And that's important to note because all of these pieces of evidence that are being collected are going to be contested in court. If anyone is familiar with this case, they know one of the things that the defense team really hammers on is the idea that this was a group of racist cops who were planting evidence at Simpson's North Rockingham estate in order to frame him for this murder. And they're going to be able to use these Reeboks as part of that defense. The fact that they were not turned in that day, and that there is no real way to say what happened with those Reeboks prior to their being turned in. Once home, Lang puts the shoes in a cardboard box for safekeeping in order to turn it over the next day, whereas Van Adder, who has also left the scene by this point in time, is in touch with Marcia Clark, informing her that he believes they'll have a case ready for her by the end of the week, as well as about the blood sample that Simpson gave. Clark is enthused about this, obviously, and thus ends the activities of June 13th, 1994. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope my Deathcasters and Deathcasterette enjoyed this extended edition. I will be back next week with part 4. Until then, stay morbid!